Hey, everyone. Thank you so much. While our team is coming up, I just want to say this is, how many of you have seen Hamilton? Listen to the music? This is the room where it happens. All right, we're in it, and we're going to get closer to some of the people who are making unbelievable changes. And hopefully you won't hear much from me. I just got to say, our panel today, looking at disruption and what's going on, many of you can see the titles and the people up on the screen, but we've got a money person, an AI leader, and two tech innovators. And I think that gives us a good balance to understand what's happening. So I'm just going to start the questions, and I'm going to go and save a little bit of time to come into the audience and take a couple of questions from the audience so we can make it a little bit more interactive. So, Melissa, I just want to start with you. You have an amazing job at NBC Universal running finance for television production, and you've had a great career. Tell me a little bit, what is it about onboarding new technologies like paperless workflows and other things that you've done in the last 2 years at NBC? What does it take to get people to adopt a new technology?
First of all, it has to work. And I guess that's what I'd say. About 5 years ago, when I started wanting to do get rid of paper in production, because 20 years ago it was all paper. A lot of it's still paper when I visit production offices. But what really got me excited was when we finally had the technology with Smart Start, for example, that we are doing electronic onboarding. You know, it is a legacy, kind of entrenched in paper. People are like, they're never going to do electronic. No, they won't touch this electronic system, which we all use every day. So in the last 2 years, once it started to work, we have now onboarded 28,000 crew members, which is huge. Funny thing now is how I get people into change. You can't drive change by dictating it from above. You let a few people try it, and the word spreads. And all of a sudden, people started calling us. Hey, can our Chicago shows get on to Smart Start? Can our New York shows? So all of a sudden, they want to get on board as opposed to pushing it down. So that's what I always do. I just let the success breed success.
So this whole paperless workflow, this is something, Patrick, that your company developed. And so you thought there was a need in the marketplace. What were you thinking, and what did it take to get the adoption?
Yeah, so Melissa brings up some great points. It had to work. We knew that. But at the same time, I think what you're looking for is a way to provide, not only does it work, but it provides value to the people using it. And so, as she says, is you launch something that you think is good, and you've done all your customer research to ensure that you're adding value and doing the right things. But at the end of the day, it will actually sell itself if it really solves important problems for our customers. So as we worked with Melissa and her team, one of the key things that we found is we just had to find a good partner on the client side that would help us go through. You always have growing pains. You always do your best to figure out, what's the best solution I can put out there. But at the same time, you can't do it within your own four walls. You have to get out and actually talk to customers and work with them. And Melissa and her team were just really great about that. And so we refined it, and we hit home run with it.
I love it. James, at 20th Century Fox, you've got one of the more fascinating jobs as the SVP for technology and innovation. And you're trying to help bring some of the new disruptive talent technologies to filmmaking. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing, and especially with Fox 2000 and Searchlight, what you've been doing with learning to identify book properties for acquisition.
Sure. So something that we're fascinated with, I'm sure everyone in this room knows, when you're purchasing a book, it's incredibly competitive. We all have book agents. We're all looking at New York Times bestsellers lists. But there's thousands, if not millions, of books that potentially represent great opportunities to tell stories or be adapted into films. So our idea was basically, why don't we sort of bring in all those reviews? Like, let's look at barnesandnobles.com, let's look at Goodreads, let's look at Amazon, let's see where we can find, sentiment and a level of sentiment and intensity of sentiment that is similar to, books that were previously adapted to film successfully, right? So, I think ultimately what we're always trying to figure out when it comes to, data and storytelling is what's the relationship, right, between the product, like what's in it, and the people that we're trying to get to consume it, right? And so we're always trying to look at different sort of data sources that can help us build those muscles so we can, do that kind of strategy and build those applications.
So when we think about filmmaking and technology, we're always thinking about special effects, but where you're focused is really looking at creating a digital framework for a studio. I don't know what that means.
Well, I think in terms of what I'm principally responsible for, you know, I'm not looking at how we've done things in the past and incrementally making each of those things better. I'm responsible for looking ahead and saying, what is the absolute future of storytelling? Full stop. What does that look like, and how can we begin to sort of see ourselves getting there? So when I look at a digital framework, it all starts principally with the people who make our content, right? It's the creatives who produce the actual films, that produce the stories. And so how do I sort of build the applications around them that help them, you know, not necessarily lift the floor of our box office, but sort of raise the ceiling of the potential of our creators?
Right. That's a perfect segue to Eves. What you're doing in studying AI and filmmaking at USC is a perfect segue, because you're doing brain mapping, you're looking at the analysis of characters and scenes and seeing what resonates. Can you talk a little bit about the work that you're doing and how you're approaching fine-tuning story making for films?
Yeah, so we're doing brain-to-brain mapping. We're using all the data that's available and a lot of very, very high-end knowledge representation and AI techniques to really understand the relationship between very intrinsic aspects of content, like emotional journeys, emotional tonality of characters, and we are building this map of emotional journeys of characters across thousands of films and thousands of TV shows and books and things like that, and using social media data to look at, well, what intrinsic dimensions of emotional tonality of character or narrative structure, and how do they resonate with various audience segments, and how's that driving performance positively or negatively? So it's really brain-to-brain mapping, looking at, and we can even go even further, one step below that, look at the type of creatives that have been involved in creating a piece of content and reverse engineer their creative journey and try to predict what kind of creative journey is able to generate some specific narrative structures and attributes that are going to be successful. And next year, we're putting people in fMRI machines and making them watch movies and TV shows to look at the actual neurobiology behind affinity, behind emotion and cognitive impact. And when that happens, it's game over.
So at the end of the day, what we're really talking about is, in a high-risk business, getting risk-averse people to accept the concept of taking more risk in their job by maybe working with a technology that they're unsure of, not confident in, and changing the way they move forward, hoping for a greater success, a greater efficiency. Is that right? I mean, talk a little bit about risk-taking in this business.
I mean, I think that everyone at least the people that I work with have embraced that, you know, our industry has been incredibly disrupted. So there's not really, you know, a case I need to make that we need to transform ourselves to better compete. But the idea is coming to a consensus on what that transformation should look like. And I think that when we go in and say, you know, these are the things that we're going to automate, we're going to lift the floor of our performance to make sure that, you know, everything that we make is going to hit certain numbers, I think that sort of dampens the spirit of what, you know, makes a studio a studio. I think you fundamentally need to say, how do we identify and find stories in the way that we always have that people never forget? And what's the role that technology plays in that? And so I feel like when we set up the conversation at Fox in that way, we find a lot of willing partners in our creative departments and our creative ranks, because they want to be a part of doing what they've always done better, right? But, you know, sort of building that conversation and driving it forward in the right way, I think, is definitely a challenge and a responsibility.
I think risk is the oh. Go ahead.
I was just talking about how we're looking at our industry and it's being disrupted. So we're looking at new experiences, for example, with technology like VR, and SNL now has a VR. So there's new experiences. There's also the monetization, right? So we're also looking at ways to monetize content outside of the ad-supported model, because no one likes commercials. That's why, for example, in today's show, they're getting more into e-commerce. So I feel like I think it's a risk-averse industry, but we're being forced to adapt. So I don't think it's an option to stay where we are. So back to you.
Yeah, so we think a lot about risk. In fact, that's the first thing we think about. And risk is really the 900-pound gorilla in this industry. So if you look at the state pace of cinematic stories that have been told so far, and the state pace in game theory is the number of legal board positions that a game can be in. So the state pace of cinema and TV is about 55,000 unique stories. The state pace of human consciousness is trillions of times that. And what's happened is creatives actually sample from the probability distribution of characters' character identity, emotional journeys, topics, narrative structures, etc., to create. That sampling is on a very, very small spectrum of the probability distribution, in part because risk is being assessed so poorly, and frankly, there's just really, up to now, wasn't a lot of data to assess risk. So the spectrum of possible stories is very, very narrow, and I think at the most philosophical and probably the most interesting level, what people like James or I do is to trigger an explosion in creativity in the number of stories that are allowed to be told, right? With some measure of financial success and financial performance. I think we're sitting on the cusp of a literal explosion of creativity in Hollywood, and I'm very, very long on that. And I think, in fact, I think the entertainment industry is going, because it's so adept in producing something that is so fundamental in human civilization, which is stories, is going to dominate the economy and society. If you look at the AT&T Warner possible merger or the Comcast NBC merger, it's not technology companies that are acquiring media companies, it's technology companies that are becoming media companies. I think media is really, really going to dominate the economy and certainly dominate the technology industry and maybe even dominate society. I think we're sitting on on the front lines of a huge revolution in how powerful we can make stories and how diverse and how personalized and how impactful from a cognitive standpoint. And that's really something that everybody in this industry needs to understand. The future is extraordinary.
I was just going to ask you, Eve, how do you see the studios getting involved with your work, and have you talked to studios? I'm kind of curious because
I'm
very
working
compelling
with,
idea.
I'm working with two-thirds of the company on this panel, in fact. Well, they're very interested, obviously, right? If you're telling them that they can reduce their costs and be more financially perform better and empower their creatives versus saying no all the time. I think the studios are really tired of saying no all the time. I think they just want to to say yes more. And I think if you're telling the studios that you can look into their audience's brains and use that to tell better stories, more personalized stories, and more impactful stories, I mean, they're going to be on board.
You know, it's kind of interesting because we talk about transforming the industry, and you know, technology certainly is doing that. And there's, in regards to risk, we talk about risk to the industry, we talk about risk to, you know, the business. But one in the opening remarks, and DeVita had mentioned this, you know, when it comes down to it, and we started as a payroll company, right? And it really was about the outcome, and it was how it impacted humans. And so as we look at helping clients adopt technology, one of the things we can't forget is it's really, you know, it's about personal risks, right? So we find a good partner. Can we make that person look good? And it comes down to, you know, starts very wide at the industry level, but it really goes down to the personal level. And as you try to, you know, help people adopt different things that you think will help them, you know, a lot of it really has to do with how does it impact them personally. I think that's something that we can't lose sight of as technologists, is that there is a huge human component to this industry that can't go underneath or unnoticed.
So I love what you're saying, Patrick, because honestly, I think every single creative we work with, whether it's an actor, director, writer, talks about a personal relationship that they have with the story, with what was being told. And yet AI feels so impersonal. Does it make it more personal? Is there a resistance from creatives to embracing machine learning and AI?
I think that there is when you sort of set the field goal in the wrong place, right? When you're trying to say, hey, look, we can get a computer to write a script so that it's going to work for sure, and your role in that is more limited. You're going to be more of a curator. Like, no one wants to hear that. I mean, what I tell them is that, I don't know where I heard this, but photography didn't end art. It just freed up artists to do more expressionism, right? And so I think when you, you know, help them see that it can be so helpful to their creative process, and that's what you're trying to transform, there's a lot of interest and there's a lot of excitement.
Yeah, I think there's a wrong way to do it and the right way to do it. The wrong way to do it is to, first of all, the wrong way to do technology is to build technology that enslaves people. Technology should be a vector of freedom and not enslavement. I think that's something that really finally society is waking up to with, you know, Facebook and everything that's happened. So that's really number one. Number two, the wrong way to do this is to average everything that's been done before and do the same thing. That's not going to work because you're dealing with an audience of experts through this industry. Like, the audience is an expert in your product, which is very unique if you think about it. We're not experts in cars, right? So, and experts want novelty. And so the entire, a lot of what's going on in Hollywood right now is trying to understand where to innovate in the storytelling process and where to keep to the canons. And you can't innovate in the wrong places. And so AI really can help that. And what we're doing is, again, looking at that sampling, that really narrow sampling of the whole probability distribution of human consciousness, and only tell those stories over and over again. We want to extend that. We want to empower creative. We want to unleash them beyond the scope of what they themselves can even think is possible right now, because the space of possible stories that can really touch us is near infinite, and certainly trillions of times bigger than the space of the stories we've been telling today.
Got
That's
it.
What AI is going to do.
So I just want to take a moment. We're going to be coming into the audience and asking some questions in just a minute. So think about what you want to ask this fantastic panel. And what I want to ask is, there's a lot of ambitious people in this room, much like yourselves. I want to be 30 years old and an SVP. How did I miss that? And and I want you to, each of you, as I'm going down to the audience, just kind of go down the road, and what advice would you give to this crowd in terms of what should they be looking at? What skills should they be embracing to be able to prepare for this disruptive future that we're part of and is only going to speed up in the level of change? What skills do we need? Where should we be thinking about ahead?
I mean, I would say that I have a relentless discipline about never forgetting that what's driving disruption and wherever I am is the customer. I feel like it's really easy to get caught up in, you know, what technology is doing, what competitors into the market are doing. But at the end, you know, America's getting browner. Globalization is changing the nature of audience, you know, taste, aspirations. And so I feel like, you know, being rigorous about understanding what the implications of that are have been the difference in my career. And, you know, sort of starting there and working up into strategy is really important.
Yeah, I would kind of piggyback on that, too. I think customer, you know, relentless focus on the customer. And I think the second thing I would add to that is, you know, you just have to get comfortable with change. It's here. It's not going away. And if you don't get comfortable with change, then you risk being stagnant. And so I think that's, you know, becoming a skill set that we all need with the rate that things are changing.
I'm going to go a couple level downs from, and so I'm going to say I agree with what's been said. We'll just go a little level down. What you've been saying is you have to worry about neuroscience. Everything happens over here. And we have now the models and the technologies to really understand the neuroscience of things, and neuroscience, and certainly from my standpoint, the neuroscience of story. So I would say all in on neuroscience. If you think about it, science is like economics, psychology, psychiatry, are actually pseudoscience. They're all place, what I call placeholder science for neuroscience. It's really the ability to understand how our neurobiology triggers a certain type of behavior at a very, very granular mathematical level is going to revolutionize everything.
Melissa?
I'd like to piggyback off what everyone said. I think these are great ideas. I also think we have to look at everything with fresh eyes, everything that we do, and look at it from a human level. And I like the way you talk about neuroscience, because I think it requires leadership. And there's actually a lot of groundbreaking studies on the neuroscience of leadership and how you affect people. I think one thing we get caught up when we talk about technology, everyone says, oh, I'm not really a technology person. I think it's all human first. That's what technology is, really just kind of bringing people together. And I think we have to be strong leaders.
That's great. So questions from the audience? I want to be able to, any hands? Hands up? Anyone? Should I keep going? We like it. By the way, while I'm looking, we have one question over here. Melissa has the best title job in a former job. I think my mother would have had this title. She was VP of Continuous Improvement at Viacom. Is that not the best
title? The great title, because anything I do is an improvement by definition.
Right. Hi, my name is Yael Miller. I am at Disney in the direct-to-consumer and international division. My question is actually for James. If you could talk a little more about what you do, it sounds really fascinating, especially as a personal book lover and who's interested in adaptation.
Sure. So, you know, we've had a lot of success with adaptation. We did, you know, Gone Girl, we did Hidden Figures, and, you know, we're constantly looking for new material. And I think the challenge that we face is that we're constantly, you know, in a bidding war for something that's not even yet been released. And, you know, how can we get more data points to better understand exactly what the potential of this book is? So the first thing is, what is the most appropriate comp? So instead of a bunch of us sort of sitting around reading it and saying, oh, yeah, I think this is sort of like Harry Potter, right? It's really just making sure our machines read enough volume of books to understand, you know, the different sort of characteristics within the book, character types, tropes, things like that, so we can really understand what is the closest comp, right? And then that way we can at least see what the financial opportunity there is. And I think the second piece, which I'm much more excited about, is figuring out how to take the unstructured data, the comments, and see what about this book is most compelling to whom. Can we get into our DMP, understand who that person is that made that comment, and get those get that demographic data? And if you do that at enough scale, right, you start to get some, you know, statistically reliable models, and that the elements within this particular book are going to be compelling to these types of audience, which represents this type of opportunity. And we try to use it, you know, not to just make decisions on the things that are obvious, but to identify opportunity where other people potentially aren't looking. And when we're one company, we can do that together.
Hi, John Huberman from Uyala. Eve's question for you. You talked a little bit about AI. I hear a lot about AI, machine learning. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between the two?
Yes. AI is a very broad area of research and technology that includes aspects of it, like knowledge representation. How do you take atomic level data and represent it in a way that a machine can understand and read it? That's not machine learning. You know, saying that AI machine learning is the same thing is it's like saying that the color orange is an orange are the same thing. Obviously, it's not. One is a property or the other. Machine learning is one domain of AI. It's a very, very important domain of AI, but it's only one domain of AI. And it includes about a dozen other domains. And as a matter of fact, I'm about to publish a paper on this next week, which you're all welcome to get. That goes very, very deep, like 300 pages deep, into the topic. The major difference between AI and machine learning is that not only machine learning is a property of AI, it's a layer in AI. An AI application will have agency, and a machine learning application will not have agency, right? So a machine learning application will be part of an AI application, which will make autonomous decisions and recursive self-improving decisions. So a self-driving car is definitely an AI application. A Go-playing application is an AI application. If your application is not making decisions on its own and self-improving on these decisions, it's not an AI application. You don't need AI for 99% of things. Machine learning works fairly well, but don't get fooled by marketers. 99% of what you hear called AI is actually not AI, it's machine learning.
Other questions from back here? Any hands? Over here, yes, great.
Good morning, Daniel Kenyon with Furious M. This is to the whole panel, but there might be some special direction. I'm curious as to see if you're focused on the demographic of under 13, under 12s, and what effect producing content that is targeted at children will have on their cognitive development. Are you looking at that already? Is it a consideration?
I can start. We're not, but we are going to. You know, as I said, as soon as you start measuring people's brain activity and neurobiology, and by the way, the field is called computational neuroscience, and I think it's going to change everything in society. And so once you start understanding the impact of narrative on behavior. And it's really, at the end of the day, it's what we're trying to do. Right? We're trying to hack the cognitive relationship between audiences and stories, and how do those stories trigger behavior. So I've, and this is really, really important, because stories, as you'll see in my paper, are one of the most critical cognitive drivers. A story is actually a mathematical compression mechanism for the brain to be able to process the enormous complexity of the universe that we live in and process that into a set of behavioral steps. So that compression drives our behavior. So it's extremely important. So the answer is no, we're not. But we are going to. And when we do, and that's why I believe in computational neuroscience so much, is that when we do, we'll be able to create a much, much, much better world.
Anyone else want to tackle that? Hey, Guy, can I put you on the spot? Will you make Eve's paper available to everyone as part of our recap?
If Eve makes it available to me, I will make it available to all.
All right, here we go.
That's how we roll.
Are you a subscription
model?
No,
it's free.
Free.
It's free.
Thank you, Eve.
All right, we love
that. Of course, of course.
So, hi, my name is Eric Ralston. I'm the chief architect of LiveTiles, a technology company using artificial intelligence and making available artificial intelligence for various business purposes. And I'm hearing some fascinating use cases and possibilities for its application. I'm hearing about sentiment analysis of audiences and crunching big data to turn your audience's story into a story that you can tell back to the audience. And first off, these types of applications are extremely diverse, and I want to know, what is it that you do to forecast to the shift? Once you make a story that is successful, how do you then spin off that story? I know Hollywood makes a lot of sequels, but generating a sequel needs to take in the next step. So where do you see the applications for AI moving? Because it is a fashion-driven industry, how do you make a fashionable machine learning algorithm?
So, interesting question. There's actually a mathematical model behind this, which we've developed at ETC called interestingness. There's actually a mathematical representation of everything that we find interesting, and I'll tell you what it is. In everything that we find interesting, whether it's a person or a character or a book or a movie, there is a similar ratio of attributes about that thing that we already know about that thing that help us represent what that thing is about, and attributes of novelty on top of it. If all the attributes of something are in the known and expected domain, which is in the brain, causes really high compression of input data, it's boring. If all the attributes of something are in the novelty domain, which in the brain causes very low compression of data, it's very, very overwhelming. Everything that is interesting to us is in that ratio of elements that are expected to elements that are new. And there's a way to measure that, and that's what we're doing.
James, Melissa?
I was just curious if you can distill that. You know, everyone says it sounds so scientific, the story. You feel like you can really distill something? I mean, would you use this for focus groups as well, or just in the ideation stage?
Yeah, we can to a certain extent, right? So it's really, we're not at a level of granularity that is total, which is why we want to use fMRI machines to get there. But we're able to predict a lot of the success of brands on social media, for example, looking at the conversation around them, and is the conversation reflect that ratio of elements about the brand or the film that are traditionally associated with that brand, and the ratio of new elements and new topics on top of that, and we're able to calculate that.
I'd like to just take it down to the final word, and that's about failure. Because in all of our careers, we are terrified of it, and yet it happens. So talk about what failure means at Fox now in your role. And each of you, if you can just give me a short sentence, because we're out of time, that would be fantastic and a way to end. Let's talk about failure and where we're going with it.
I think failure for me is failure becoming unacceptable at Fox. I think a huge part of the first couple of years that I've been at Fox is getting people comfortable with the fact that we need to try things. I think corporations in general, I mean, I started my own company before this, so this is my first job, are weighed down by this sense of incrementalism. Like, if we just do a little bit more, a little bit better, let's all pat ourselves on the back while we're just really getting our ass beat everywhere. Like, that's not what I'm into. So what I'm trying to sort of focus on as it relates to failure is saying, If we don't fail, we're not trying hard enough. If we're not trying hard enough, we're not going to compete. If we don't compete, we don't really deserve the hearts and minds we're trying to win. And so for me, it's, you know, failure is something that's not something I'm afraid of. It's something I'm afraid will become stigmatized.
Okay, Patrick, top that.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Yeah, I guess I'll just be short. But I think failure in the grand scheme of things is just one more step closer to success. And I think that's how you have to look at it.
I look at failure in terms of failure at what cost. You know, I think one of the things that I would love to see emerge in the industry is a space of experimentation and prototyping of new stories at a very much lower budget price point. And I think I really like what's going on with all the OTT, the energy around the OTT, because OTT really, and AI, because if we can bring the cost of production of content way down, and we can create very, very innovative content that really pushes that layer of novelty that I was talking about on OTT and experiment that way, that's a really great way of then prototyping and experimenting with something that, if you think about it, is extremely complex. And so I think it's we need to fail, but we need to fail at lower price points and in ways that is very data-driven, so we understand what's failed about it, which is why all of this conversation is so interesting.
Last word.
Failure, for me, is a lack of imagination of what could be.
Here we have it. We are on time. Thank you all. Let's give it up for this incredible panel. Thank you.
And thank you, Bob Gold.